listeners, and welcome to a second episode of First Name Basis, an installment on 80K After Hours, where three 80K employees talk to someone they think is doing good work in the world, who Rob Wiblin wouldn't deign to interview for some reason that we don't quite understand. I'm Matt from the one-on-one team at 80K, and with me are these people.
Hi, I'm Bella. I do outreach at 80K.
I'm Arden. I head web at 80K.
And our special guest today is Mr. Joel Becker, who, like our first guest, is on the verge of leaving the United Kingdom for his beloved America. Hannah was from America. Joel is not. But he is very excited about his upcoming move. Joel, do you want to say anything about your upcoming move?
I'm really excited about it. it's been a... Are we allowed to swear?
Yes.
It's been a really fucking long time. very painful. And yeah, I'm really, really fucking relieved that it's happened.
And anything about America in particular making it a choice destination for you?
People ask me why I like America, and they I think they expect this like 3-point bullet list or something. And I say everything because I feel everything. It's easier to come up with a bullet point list for why I don't want to, possible reasons why I wouldn't want to be in America. So yeah, the whole package.
If you had to like cut reasons off of this list that you'd feel less bad about cutting, like which kind of reasons would be left over if you only had like 5?
Oh, I see.
Wait, is that going to be like an infinitely long list? If right now it's everything?
No, I'm saying, imagine that you cut everything but 5. What would be the 5 essentials?
Oh, got it. Yeah, that sounds good.
You'd leave behind.
Yeah, yeah. So, something about, you know, the energy or entrepreneurialness of people I tend to meet. Maybe this isn't reflective of American society. Maybe it's reflective of the circles that I move in the US versus the UK. But definitely something there. I was... it's a little difficult to communicate, but I thought Americans earning so much more would not be a big deal, either for me personally or like a very noticeable thing day to day. But actually, crops up in my life in a bunch of ways I didn't expect. That feels important. Best years of my life were in America. You know, I want to go back to those particular relationships. Climate's better.
Climate's better.
Maybe that's not true.
I feel like
well, where you going?
Oh, I prefer the politics. There we go.
You prefer the politics?
Wow. That's a hot take.
I find
British politics quite. There's a lot of euphemism that I feel uncomfortable with. Like it's a thing that you're able to do as a respected regular op-eds writer in the Times is to shit on Muslims, and in the US there's more like plain facedness about it, and I kind of prefer that aesthetically.
I mean, I have so many questions, but Bella, Arden, you guys just jump in.
I feel like I understand the thing you're talking about as an aesthetic preference, but I'm also like, it probably just seems objectively worse that it's like, I feel like the fact that you have to cloak when you're saying something that some people find morally abhorrent is a sign of the fact that people are at least aware that it's morally abhorrent. And that like seems to be kind of a good thing.
Yeah. I don't want to say, I don't want to make strong claims beyond this aesthetic preference. Maybe this is a separate point.
Uh-huh.
A view that I came to the US with, that I feel like lots of British people have, is something like, you know, Americans, they're like barbaric, right? Like we see the news, you know, terrible things are happening in the streets of America, things that couldn't possibly happen in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think like one reason I've come to think of that as more complicated is that a lot of those things do happen in the UK. And another reason is something like, this counterfactual is exceptionally unclean, but, you know, if all the people who, if the ancestors of people who, the British Empire inflicted atrocities upon were now voters in the UK, our politics might look very different. And that feels like a maybe reasonable excuse for the America's barbarism. Something like that.
Is the thing you're trying to say something like, because the UK is restricting his politics to just people who are, like, you know, right here on the island and stuff. Mm. It's like, that's the reason why things are somewhat calmer, and so it doesn't count in favor or something of the UK's culture.
Yeah.
Okay, I see. Hmm.
Yeah, so there's, I don't know, maybe that, one way that does speak to the first point is, like, a lot of the same rawness or, like, qualities that you and I might not like in US politics, things that also exist in UK politics, or they don't exist for reasons that I think of as, like, substantively or aesthetically bad.
Okay. For what's worth, my reaction is just, like, I don't really feel like I recognize this phenomenon, that people are more euphemistic in the UK, or that it's, like, somehow things are more harsh.
Have you seen that YouGov polling about what Americans hear when they hear Britishisms versus what British people hear when they hear Britishisms?
I'm not sure I've seen this exact thing, but I know that it's... Well, wait, so describe the thing.
Like, with all due respect is one good example.
Yeah.
By which we mean, like, you know, I totally disrespect you.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, I guess there's, like, the general fact that British people are more, like, circumspect in the way they speak, I guess. Mm. But I don't know, like, it feels like in politics there's still lots of, like, norms about how it is that you're supposed to act in the US, and, like, people do a lot of dog whistles and euphemisms and stuff like that. So I don't know, it just doesn't seem, like, insofar as it's more, raucous or something, it doesn't really seem like it's because it's more honest. It seems like people are just more extreme, but I don't know.
Now, getting back to the original question, I feel like
why is America great?
The politics response was a bit of a troll from Joel, and not like the genuine reason you're really excited to immigrate to this country.
Sure.
what are some of these relationships that you mentioned wanting to get back to? Anything you want to share?
I'm not sure. This is quite in the weeds. Thinking mostly of people I became good friends with in Boston outside of the EA world, which. Some important diversification there. No, it's true. Versus, you know,
I agree.
In London, of course, in London where I grew up, you know, 10 years ago, none of my friends would have thought of themselves as EAs. And, like, nowadays, as, this year when I've been back for 8 months, quite the opposite is true. I think it's nice for me to be in an environment where that's not so fully the case.
Yeah, and I guess, like, I don't know, speaking of really cool relationships, one thing that you wanted to come and talk to 80,000 Hours about was kind of the relationship element undertoning one of our most popular podcast episodes, where our former CEO Howie came on and he talked about his struggles with mental health. And I think you one time told me that you had maybe an unusually negative reaction to this podcast, at least insofar as it was advice, but I'll let you speak to your kind of maybe unique reaction to it.
Describing me as wanting to talk about this.
Oh, as me just dragging Joel to say something about content that we produced.
I thought it was very graceful the way you did that just now.
The segue was...
No, the segue was fantastic. I feel compelled to add a bunch of caveats. It feels like this is a... very unpopular thing to think or say, and, you know, and I gather that Howie is I haven't really spoken with him, but a wonderful and very competent person, and in fact, you know, all of the things that are kind of on my mind are things that he brings up himself in the episode. You know, it is striking to me the degree of support that Howie gets. It seems both the housing support, but then maybe more importantly, the professional support after his periods of intense mental illness feel unrepresentative of what listeners might experience. And I'm curious about whether the testimonials that ATK has collected about how this is the best episode that this listener has ever listened to are from people who are in a somewhat similar situation to Howie. Hmm. That's the take.
Should we talk, like, about... Should we, like, explain more what this is referring to? Just to...
Well, people should go back and listen to the episode.
They should go back and
listen to
the
one thing,
episode,
I think
sure.
It was from, like, April of 2021.
It's episode number 100, so you
episode
can't miss
number
it.
100.
Very good.
Easy to remember.
I mean, so our former CEO, I think, like, the biggest thing that I took away, I mean, the premise of the episode was that he was just talking about all of the struggles that he's had with mental health and anxiety while trying to do a bunch of good in the world. And I think the real highlight was there was like a 12 or like 18 month period where he like literally did nothing. He had a breakdown over something that seemed small at the time, but he kind of spiraled. And lost
his job over it.
Yeah.
And did lose his job over it. And basically all the things that he did and tried and experimented with to come out of that successfully, then being CEO of 80,000 Hours for a while, CEO of Effective Ventures, our sort of like parent organization for a while. And now he's actually going back to the employer he had at the time, Open Philanthropy, because they were sort of like very eager to get him back. So he just talked about like the real like concrete things that he experienced and then that he did to get to a better place later. And there's a lot of detail, and maybe it matters to some of Joel's reaction, but I think maybe something underpinning it was there were just like awesome people with good ideas and a lot of energy to help support him that maybe, you know, most people who listen to that wouldn't have available to them.
I will say, I think, so I loved the episode and was like really excited for us to release it and felt like it was really moving. And I'm going to also say a bunch of caveats and you can cut all of this out later or something like that if you want. But I do remember there was a striking moment where he talked about, you know, he like didn't check his email for, you know, several months or something like that. And then when he finally checked it, they were like, okay, I might be butchering this, but it was something like, all of his emails, there were like four people being like, hey, want to come work for my organization whenever you're ready or something like that, which does seem like it's potentially an unusual thing to happen after something like this.
Yeah, I don't mean on the basis of that, like, you shouldn't have been super proud for 80K to put out that episode. I agree, it's very emotionally moving. I agree, although it hasn't been stated, but probably agree that it contains some great concrete advice. I'm just being terribly meta and vibesy.
Is it correct to summarize your position as something like, this episode shows a person dealing with these struggles from a fundamentally very safe and secure position, or like from a position where they could expect a lot of support, and therefore it's going to be unrepresentative, and that might be harmful because then people will expect something different or whatever?
I'm not sure he could have reasonably expected the level of support that he...
Right.
If you believe Howie's accounts, then you know he stresses his negatives more than others deem reasonable, and so maybe he doesn't expect that these job offers are going to come or something like that. One of the concrete bad things in the world that I think might happen as a result of this, possibly nothing. You know, that's not necessarily fun to take. To the extent that there is something, yeah, I guess it's just, you know, people feeling bad they don't have that level of support.
Yeah.
Not necessarily expecting that they will have that level of support.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think this is just one of those... Maybe this is going to sound excessively trivializing, but I am kind of like, man, communicating about things that are extremely personal and, like, very context-specific is really hard.
Mm.
And, like, I don't know, like, other people on the team have tried to write things that are, like... trying to explicitly generalize about like the kinds of things you might do or the kinds of things you might expect, where I feel like Howie was a lot just talking about his own experience on that episode from memory. This is really freaking hard because
totally.
The boring fact that different situations are different and different people can and should expect very different levels of support and response and so on.
Yeah, I mean, also, like, the episode would have been lame if he was just speaking generalizations. I think in many ways it was good that he was able to tell his story specifically.
I mean, if there's a harm here, I think it could come from just underlining the fact that, like, as opposed to, like, leading to different expectations or not being good advice for particular people, underlining the fact that, like, I mean, presumably... it has something to do with the fact that he's, like, very talented and good at various things, and people might feel like... great, so, I mean, if I fall off the face of the earth or whatever for a while, like, this isn't going to happen. Why? Because I'm, like, not as desirable, not as employable, and that, like, just kind of sucks and might feel like a bit of a... it might feel very salient.
That went better than I was expecting.
Yeah.
No knives have come out.
I feel like this is a bad sign for our culture that it's like he's like very he has to like
be really
careful about making any criticism.
No, it's not the culture. It's like we all have overlapping friendships, and I've like sat here in an 80,000 hours office.
Well, it'll might please you to know the 80,000 hours office has no booby traps anywhere that are triggerable. So
Yeah, I guess that was more of a Joel specific. Paranoia feels like too strong a word, but you know, people really liked the episode, and Joel, you feel like a lot of people in your social circles really liked it, and so and like in a deeply personal way or something like that. But anyway, I'm glad you could air that. I think it's true. I think like maybe what a lot of people were saying in their very like positive responses was just like I heard something in here that like spoke to my experience and felt very real, and maybe a few smaller somethings that felt like pragmatic and practical, like talking about all of his experimentation with like different therapists and different medications and things like that. And I think a lot of people often just need a nudge to be more experimental or something like that, and it can apply to many different contexts. Even though there were some of these undercurrents of like, yes, Howie's immensely talented, and has lots of opportunities and lots of people who are going to like want him to recover because they can, you know, they can work with him. And that's not going to be true for everyone. And that's a thing that is worth highlighting.
Sounds right to me.
Yeah. Well, anyway, speaking of things that, that Joel is a bit nervous about. Joel, how are we
working on these segues?
Joel, how do we know you?
I'm not totally sure how I know Bella.
I can tell you when we first met. Do you want to know?
Was it an EAG?
No. Well, maybe. I, like, saw you in the EAG.
Okay.
But I think when we first met was when you were at the pub. It was your birthday, and Benjamin wanted to go, and he brought me along. It was nice. We sat in a pub for a bit and chatted.
Is just over the last 8 months while you've been here?
No, that was
Or before that?
2 years ago or something.
I think it... Yeah, whatever. It was some amount of time ago.
So that's how I know everyone.
Thanks, Tathan.
Great.
I think the time when I got to know you best, I'd met you briefly. Both here you made a little visit to the office and at EAG. But I spent 3 weeks in the Bahamas where you happened to be. And I shouldn't say happened to be because you kind of invited me there. You were running a program with a now defunct philanthropic organization. I mean, to put it lightly, I mean, Joel, you work for the FTX Foundation. And you put on the Fellows and Visitors Program in the Bahamas, where people working on projects that the foundation was excited about funding, or like potentially funding, would come and kind of collaborate and co-work and do things like that. And I visited for a couple weeks. I think, Arden, you also visited.
I was also there, yeah, and that's also where Joel and I met.
For a few weeks. And I imagine most of our audience kind of knows, like, the FTX story. It's like this cryptocurrency firm that had a relatively small philanthropic arm, but like significant, especially significant for us and our listeners, probably. You know, and then it turned out to be, like, rooted in a deep fraud, the cryptocurrency firm, and that obviously, you know, has spillover effects to the foundation collapsed along with the firm. I think a lot of people who were involved with that, and probably all four of us, like, feel some degree of shame to have, like, been associated with this thing, and you were, like, relatively closely associated with it. So, I mean, that's, like, the long arc of it. But I did want you to speak to both sides, because in you know, 2022, when you were, like, doing the work, I imagine it felt, like, quite exciting. Like, there were a lot of things happening here, and, of course, then you have, like, feelings about what happened after. So, yeah, I mean, I just, like, the people you met, the kind of projects you felt, maybe my real, like, operationalizable question is, like, you know, at the time, like, before the collapse, you know, I think the program sort of wound up in July or something like that, which was several months before all this came to light. Yeah, did you feel like it was, like, a really good use of time and resources? Because there were other arguments, even at the time, that this is kind of excessive and unnecessary to fly people to this tropical paradise and do all these things.
Yeah, there's many, many ways to answer that question. One is, there are a lot of things that felt like, I think maybe did, make a kind of internal sense, like conditional on FTX not being a fraud. It makes sense, and now confidently after the fact it doesn't make sense. Maybe after the fact, maybe before the fact, that's true, I'm not sure. A different and much more difficult to communicate way of answering the question is that relative to the Bahamas, it would have been difficult to make things less excessive, as I think you described. Like we were kind of staying in the cheapest place, subject to some fairly basic requirements, so on and so forth.
Can you go into the kind of requirements? I think I know, but just
Yeah, so one is like having access to clean water within like 5-10 minute walk. One is everyone living in the same place. And the other, and there was a third, I'm forgetting the third, but it's kind of a similar in spirit. Yeah. Where do you want to go from there?
Just like what the people in the projects. I mean, you don't need to like name names and be super specific, but like, what was the energy like? Do you feel like people were being like really creative and coming up with good and valuable things that justified
the projects were good, yeah.
The cost, yeah.
I mean, there are some things that don't make sense now because the bar has changed.
The money's no longer there.
Because the money's
for the projects.
There.
Yeah.
And I was skeptical of various political projects at the time. And still am skeptical that was something that made sense ex ante. But on the whole, I think they're pretty great things.
But are you talking about projects by the foundation directly funded, or of the fellows coming in to hang out and talk? So like,
I mean, the fellows coming in.
Okay, I see. Yeah, so it did feel like it had this like salon energy or whatever. I don't know, where you like bring people together and they like end up with more creative things and felt intellectually exciting.
Yeah,
I mean that's good.
Yeah.
Arden, do you think you made good use of your time there?
No. I don't think I don't think it was a productive thing for me to be there. I feel like I'm like a weird person who has trouble, who like has a lot of like office environment needs, and I really struggled with the office environment there. And so I ended up like staying home a lot and then not like, seeing people as much. And like, you know, I think it was,
And?
Hmm?
And you were out for like 2 weeks with COVID, weren't you?
Oh, that's true. I was out for 2 weeks with COVID. Yeah, that did not help. I think like it was an interesting experience for me, but it was not. I don't think that was justified after the fact. Even you know before everything came to light.
I feel pretty similarly about when I went there. I kind of just like tried to do things that I would normally do if I were in my own office and didn't get a whole lot done. And felt kind of isolated. I did go because it felt like this was going to be part of effective altruism history, and I guess it certainly did. Not in the way that I anticipated at the time. There was and I don't know if we want to segue back to talking about America, but there was an energy there in terms of ambitious people who want to meet new people and collaborate and do cool things. It was like a tiny little Silicon Valley.
For better and worse.
For being charitable, yeah. For better and worse. But you're about to go to the real Silicon Valley, and in our discussion about America, you didn't mention the energy. That's the number one word that you
did. I
think he did.
Oh, he did.
Yeah, he said entrepreneurialism. It was at the beginning. It went by fast.
My head is too.
You got distracted by the politics thing.
true. Cool. Do you want to talk about sauna?
Sure.
Sorry, weren't we about to talk about the energy of America or something?
Well,
entrepreneurialism? No.
We
can keep, I guess,
agree.
All right, whatever. Maybe it'll keep coming up. And
we all agree.
About, I don't know.
I don't feel like
I think we all agree.
Particularly have... I feel like the Silicon Valley thing seems like a thing, but like outside that, I don't really feel like I notice a difference in London versus in New York City or something.
So here's... I was in New York a month ago, and here's something that happened in New York that I don't think would happen in London. I landed at JFK... And I got on subway to go to Manhattan. And on the subway, two gentlemen walked into the car. And one of them had a boombox. And he started playing the boombox. And the other gentleman walked down the car and asked people to kind of like make a little space for him.
Fuck
and
yeah.
He started basically doing parkour to the music in the subway, including like putting his feet like up on the rails that you'd hold on either side of the car and sliding across upside down like a vampire. And you know, being very courteous, saying like, Thank you, New York. We love you. Any donations are much appreciated. I'm not being pushy about it at all, but there was quite some energy in the performance, and I don't think that would happen in London.
Okay, sorry. Great anecdote. We need to circle around back to the fact that you said he slid like a vampire. What is your mental image of vampires?
Well, the
hang where are you getting that from?
If you imagine that a vampire in his normal sleeping opinion, sleeping upside down like a bat.
No, a bat sleeps upside down. A vampire sleeps in a coffin. What are you talking about?
Wait. Vampires don't sleep upside down?
Like, none of them? There's not even one?
I feel like I have a picture in my head, like a cartoon vampire closes his wings in like a little cocoon. And yeah, with his little feet. And it don't they have clawed feet?
No, these are American vampires. They have more energy. They're more ambitious. They try more things.
Yeah.
And we were discussing, Joel's been living with me for the last week, FYI. Well, he tries to be as close to central London, which is the closest thing he can get to America in this country.
I was just trying to be close to America by living next to an American.
Yeah, but we have a...
Actually, usually, you know, you two have been of an aberration in this respect. But in general, the people that I find it most difficult to form good relationships with are Americans who have decided, of their own accord, not to be in the US. But it has been a pleasure to live with.
Okay.
Yeah, and I was going to allude to a conversation we had with our flatmate who's British, and he was really enamored with the idea that people queue in a very organized fashion for the subway here, and in America, I guess people just like wrestle and push and shove their way on, and you think that's the virtue of America.
I don't know, there's definitely some pushing and shoving in rush hour London. Maybe less.
But there is queuing. There's no queuing in
British.
Yeah, famously. But I don't know. I wouldn't. The subway. Anyway.
It definitely seems a lot more civilized here.
Okay.
Yeah. They even have those little Be Kind heart posters. Have you guys seen these?
Yeah. They say, like, but the posters need to be up. That suggests something. Some people are not being kind.
Yeah, but I feel like the standards are really high. They're like, one time somebody kind of cut in front of somebody else, so now we have, like, a national campaign. and they say, like, be kind, because doesn't it even say something like, other people have their own experience or something that you don't know about? Like, some, like, elaboration on why you should be kind to others.
Just be kind.
It's very sweet.
And Joel hates kindness.
Yeah, right. In America, that would never happen, which is great.
No. The American people are very kind. But almost too kind.
Oh, right.
I go on the train, everyone's interested in, you know, what's your sandwich?
What?
What's your sandwich?
For real?
Yeah.
Wait, what does that mean?
People talk to you in public in America.
Oh, yeah.
You know, in the UK, I do like it.
I feel like not that much. When I was in Brazil, this was way more of a thing.
Mm.
I mean, not me, because I don't speak Portuguese, but, like, people would have, like, a whole conversation about, like, what was going on, like, on the hike. They'd have, like, a little, like, 4-minute chit-chat thing about their lives somehow.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, in a way that felt very foreign. Sorry, this is it. But I believe America is much more like this than the UK. So wait, can we go back to the subway? Is this good? People like this? The, like, show on the subway? This is a sign of a healthy culture?
Yeah. The Americans, like, they, you know, they want to achieve excellence in the vampiring. They're very, that, you know, that is energetic and entrepreneurial in the way that I, in the way I mean to point out.
I don't know.
Yeah, I can,
they're
I,
also
I can
kind of
see
loud
that.
And annoying.
I have a little bit of that in me. Where it feels like it's like more, what do I actually believe here? I don't know what I actually believe here, but I don't feel like, it doesn't feel like an unalloyed good to me. Somehow.
Like, whenever this has happened, which it does, like, often when I travel, I, like, this is much more of a thing in other countries. It, like, feels fun because I'm, like, a tourist. I'm, like, here to fuck around. So, like, you know, some guy coming in, like, playing a thing on a saxophone, it's like, oh, cool, there's a saxophone here, you know, whatever. If this is my commute and he has specific trains that he gets every day, I'm going to murder him. I just wouldn't be able to, you know.
She would fit in America.
I did try to keep telling Joel, like, the public safety, come on. Like, at least that has to be a drawback, that you could die. But you think it's one side.
It's all part of
York.
The energy.
Not of New York.
Yeah. New York's very safe.
Yeah.
Is this just guns or is this something else?
I like, in general, New York's very safe.
I meant America public safety.
Yeah.
Being worse. I don't know. Like, is, like, car theft is, like, more, like, or, like, this kind of thing?
Yeah, but I'm not interested in owning a car.
I'm curious. Okay.
I mean,
you're un-American of you, Joel.
Actually, how
what about the car culture?
Yeah. I mean, I am very interested, for instance, in retaining my accent. I really don't want to give in to the soccer culture in America, which I don't like.
We have one of those?
Yeah. Do you play soccer?
No.
So, in the UK, if I'm playing soccer with you and you pass the ball out, you sort of make a mistake, I'm supposed to say, you know, you fucking idiot, why are you so shit?
Uh-huh.
And in America, you're supposed to say, oh, you know, good job, well done.
I see, we coddle people.
Interesting.
How does that go with our, like, cutthroat capitalism? Like, what's the...
Yeah, sports in America, just very communist. There's no, like, relegation.
No, keep going. I love this. Yeah. this is a real drawback to America.
If you do worse in your league or whatever the relevant thing is called in America, then you get preferred selection of best players the next season. There's no opportunity for your team to be sort of destroyed or demoted in the same way that there is in British soccer. So on and so forth.
Yeah, American professionals.
They're all these like salary caps
compared to Europe. If you make too much money, you just get taxed, like the progressive taxation, within the leagues and things like that. And in Europe, it's just like, oh, if you become a global brand, good for you. You just get to win every season now.
So you're saying the taxation is more progressive in the US than it is in Europe?
In sports.
In sports?
Yeah, for sure. Much more. Yeah. Like, in
it's
Europe,
so surprising.
Like, it's almost like clubs, like individual teams are so like privatized that they like can just choose not to play in the league if they don't want to in a year. And they can like make whatever market transactions they want for players and stadiums and things like that. And then in America, you have all these Byzantine rules about like how much you can spend and whether that's fair. And like if you did poorly, like last season, we need to give you all these various handouts to make sure that we like get something close to parity. And I much prefer the European version. It feels like. It was Joel nodding along. Europe, yes.
Interesting.
I just want to bring America to American sports.
I know nothing about sports ball, but I do want to try and defend the system that I know absolutely nothing about in Europe. Are you ready?
Fantastic.
Yeah, cool.
Okay. So one reason why it might be a good idea to give handouts to losing teams is that you then have a situation where, number one, teams are performing at closer to the same level as each other. So you don't have like some teams who are just going to like absolutely wipe the floor with others. Mm. And that makes for like a more exciting game ultimately, right? Like if there's just a match going on where you're like, well, it's just completely pre-decided prior to the match, who's going to win and who's going to lose. It's like not an interesting game. Whereas like if it's more like, well, you know, they've got some good players, which they got because they performed badly. And then like the other team is like, well, they're kind of the, you know, they're like the Goliath in this situation, but maybe the underdogs can get it. You know, it's like more exciting. The second thing is, I always feel like sports has a big issue with the fact that when people's teams lose, they're very, very, very sad about it.
You're going full Liblin right now, but go ahead.
Well, I know the tweet you're referring to. I remember we had a discussion about it at the time, and I don't remember exactly how that went. But I do feel like it just really sucks for people whose teams are always losing. And maybe it's better if not that.
And sometimes the women of partners whose teams lose.
Yes, also that.
What's the tweet?
Oh, Rob, well, there's a couple of tweets. There's one that's very old, where Rob suggests that, like, on priors, like, sports are net negative because you have 30 teams in the league and only one gets to be champion, so 29 people are sad, and, like one person is happy every year, which I think just, like, is a total failure to, like, yeah, like, model the mentality of sports fans. Yeah, and then I think he said also that sports should pay like some kind of luxury tax or like some kind of very much higher tax because it's all zero sum. It's just like there's a winner and a loser. Why are these like athletes making tens of millions of dollars when you could like basically tax away like 95% of them and they'd still earn enough to like do it, or you don't even care if a few of them drop out because like you'll still get this relative winning losing effect. It's also
extremely intrinsically rewarding for people and they like love doing it, so you should expect them to require less compensation actually do it and perform at high levels.
Yeah, no, seriously.
So the problem is that they can move countries so easily, right?
Well, that's one problem.
I cut you off before you were going to say it with the...
Oh, and Nate Silver kind of led the charge being like, oh, fucking Liblin, like I listened to your podcast. and how can you say something so naive? I think Rob was like, well, who cares what, like, the 100-meter dash record is, whether it's, like, half a second later because you tax people too much. Not that track and field is a particularly lucrative sport. But it's like, well, I think people in track and field really care, and they're really interested in it. They really want to invest a lot in it. And, like, it's just kind of like any other consumer product that, you know, you could say handbags are like, stupid and wasteful because people pay $10,000 for them and stuff. But, like, I don't know, like, why don't just luxury tax everything Rob doesn't like?
I mean, I don't know. I kind of feel like, I do think this feels like a failure to model like the utility that sports brings to people, but like luxury tax things that are like zero sum and basically based on like a race to the top where the top is not something that's intrinsically desirable, feels like kind of not crazy to me. Or like have some like category of goods, which would include handbags and would include sports, that like where we should like maybe have like a bit more of a questioning attitude about our loyalty to such things. That seems good.
What is intrinsically desirable and who decides? Like,
I guess I mean like I think people, okay, so that's obviously an extremely hard question, but I do feel like there's an intuitive sense in which like people will agree that aesthetic properties or like accomplishments that are sort of formally defined in order to be difficult, so like jumping a certain height or something like that, are like things that are valuable because we like invest them with value, and that they'll think some other things are going to be maybe in a somewhat different category, and maybe it doesn't go all the way to like objectively valuable because God loves it or something. But like, yeah, versus like, I don't know, people getting to spend their time the way they want, or like have friends or something like that. There's going to be maybe some intuitive difference here that wouldn't be so bad to lock onto. No?
Yeah, I just hear Arden's preferences. That's all I hear.
I feel like one thing that Arden can point to that is not just Arden's preferences is like, this thing was arbitrarily defined by like a football league who got together and was like, what are the rules of football and how are we going to make sure that it's fair and blah, blah, blah.
Sure, but like so many things are like that.
Also, I feel like I have a lot of aesthetic preferences that I will like not defend in this way or not think, they would think would fall into the other category.
Like music or whatever.
Like music or like I don't know, the like light filled rooms or something like that, being like, you know, and that's actually kind of scarce because you have to like compete with like other buildings or
So just things that Matt hates. Okay, great. Got it.
You hate music and light filled rooms?
Yes.
Okay.
And food.
Actually,
food
maybe
is something else that people would probably point to in this category.
Maybe Matt hating it is a good heuristic for the thing I'm talking about.
So here's an alternative.
Yeah.
Maybe we should subsidize professional sports because class mixing is good, and soccer in this country is one of extremely few. I can barely think of other significant institutions that see substantial mixing of social classes.
Religion?
I think that's a worse example.
I think it's worse, but I think it also has class mixing.
Sure.
Like, you know, did.
Hmm?
This country is, like, wildly irreligious.
But there's a lot of people who, like, go to church.
Is that so? Even now, in the year of our Lord 2024.
Well, you did just say the year of our Lord, mind you.
Well, and the year is based on our Lord.
yeah.
It's not until we give that up can we say that religion is truly done.
I mean, people do say common error.
Oh, but no, it's people have to go do the Kurzgesagt thing where they say it's the year 12,000 instead of the year 2000. That's how far I think people need to go before it's truly detached. Not that it's truly detached, because why'd you pick 24 of all the the last two significant figures you could?
Yeah.
But you were saying, like, yeah, religion. And I agree. And that's yeah, probably a close example, but it feels not as, it's probably similarly widespread, because there's lots of people who don't like sports and don't engage with it. But I think the enthusiasm that people bring to sports, I mean, they're much more religious about their sports than their religion, of all things, I think.
I mean, I guess it just does feel like a point in favor of both, probably. And I guess but I don't know if that would mean that you should, like, subsidize both. But I guess, like, religions are subsidized because, like, they're usually non-profits. Right? The, like, churches and stuff.
Tax. Yeah, no, I was again, thinking about US-UK differences where they have a state church here.
Oh, yeah, we do.
It's wild.
Although, when the king got crowned, he specifically left out atheists of his address. When the king did the king's speech for Christmas, he specifically did not leave out atheists from his address.
Progress.
That's so nice.
Progress. Well, it's probably just because people on the internet got mad at him about it. I don't know. Anyway.
King Charles really, really needs to please those internet agents. An important constituency.
Yeah. He's always doom scrolling on YouTube at night.
I actually love that image so much.
We were talking about sports.
Yeah.
And our special guest has a history of sports.
Mm.
Joel, you used to do football things with statistics and making decisions, and it was, from my like very distant vantage point, an impressive and cool thing, which strangely you also feel shame about now. Or
shame?
Just, oh, okay. I mean, maybe I project shame, but like, I don't know, you're not like happy about that part of your life, you don't like to think about it.
Oh, I'm not super into football now. I think it was a wonderful thing. I don't feel shame about it. My nascent career path is very weird, and a lot of the best parts of it are owed to working in soccer statistics. So I only learned to code because I was it was helpful for working at Brentford that were one of the pioneers in this area. I had this YouTube channel that was mostly about football, and I made this one video about Brexit, and that led to internship in research economics and blah 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 blah. So yeah, I'm still pretty into the history of it.
And is that what got you onto your PhD in econ that you were working on?
Sort of. I think if I remember correctly, the actual story is when I was leaving undergrad, I had some exciting soccer statistics offer to lead something in a bad Premier League team, or maybe a good Championship team. I can't quite remember at the time. I was like thrilled about this. It kind of felt like the combination of things that I was working on whilst I was an undergraduate. And on the other hand, I'd applied to these two pre-doctoral fellowships. I didn't know what that meant in economics in the US. And one of them rejected me at CV stage immediately. And one of them, through a mix of, I'm sure, very good luck and much too hard work ahead of some of the interviews, sent me all the way, and I got the job offer. Maybe an important fact is that there isn't a lot of academic experience in my family background. I called up my economics professors, who are sort of professionals that I trusted to help me make career decisions, to ask which I should do, this like pre-doctoral fellowship or this super exciting stock statistics thing, and both of them just laughed at me. I get easily embarrassed.
The
reason I went to the US and did the academic route is that I didn't want to be laughed at.
Oh, they were laughing at the idea that you might do the soccer statistics thing?
That's so sad.
Economists who know.
I mean, it was a fantastic. They were right.
I mean, you don't get to view the counterfactual world in which you went and did soccer statistics for.
Well, I kind of do. I mean, I owned this statistics consultancy with some other people, I've seen what they've done since.
Okay.
And it's been exciting, definitely very exciting relative to the internal goals of soccer statistics. But I found out in the years since that's not so much what I'm into.
Okay, great.
Now,
but you found out that econ is also not so much what you're into.
Sure, that's true.
So you might have like ended up in the same place either way.
Yeah, but the US is the US.
You discovered America that way, bringing it back to our theme.
Yes, yes.
we'll have the flag on the wall for episode 3. I mean, Arden, you were going in the direction that I wanted to go, which is like you were doing that econ PhD, and then you left the PhD. I think in my mind you did it. You left to go and run the FTX program. Not quite though. Like, yeah, I mean, but basically you entered our universe of working on what we think are the top problems and things like that, at the expense of a PhD that you were somewhat committed to. And
yeah.
I wonder like what the decision calculus like looked and felt like at the time.
There was no decision calculus, just like US versus UK, but like all factors pointed in the direction of not economics PhD. So there was really no decision to be made.
Oh, but you were like at NYU for a year or two doing the econ PhD in America.
Yeah.
I don't know, tell us some of the factors.
Some of the factors. So here are some possible things that I could care about. Immigration to the US. Okay, that's like the only thing I care about. possibly money. Working with people that I'm excited about, who I share values with, who I think are exceptionally talented, working on projects that I'm interested in, collaborating with them on. All of those kind of factors looks better outside of the econ PhD. in academia, you have very little control over where geographically you go, following a PhD, so it may well not be in the US. Even if it is in the US, maybe not somewhere that I super want to be in the US. Even if it is somewhere I super want to be in the US, you know, there are another 4 or 5 years or something of PhD. And if I start getting sponsored for a green card or something straight away, that's many years to security in the US. Many more than if I was not doing the PhD, for example.
Although you could also, I mean, getting an econ PhD makes you like probably eminently employable in a bunch of places outside academia.
Yes.
You could think that if you're like, long-term thing is to like have a job in America.
Yeah.
You could be like, or have your pick of jobs in America.
Yeah.
You could imagine getting an econ PhD is actually a better route to that.
Totally agree. But that's where the other factors come in.
Yeah.
I didn't want to do those other jobs.
Yeah.
And I did want to do some of the things that I started focusing on instead.
What about the allure, the doctor title? Did that not sway you?
I didn't feel allure.
Okay.
I don't think... do people really use the doctor title?
I just know a number of people who do PhDs, and that was, like, just actually a material reason for them for finishing.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Not me.
Reasonable. I have one thing I want to talk to you about, and I think you guys will find it funny.
Sounds great.
Great.
Let's go.
I nearly got to having a natural segue to it, but we didn't quite make it. So Asmongold.
our inspiration in being in front of a microphone and talking to a camera.
Yeah. So okay. This guy is like a Twitch streamer.
So what was the name?
Asmongold.
Asmongold. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know what it means, neither does Matthew.
Okay.
Mm.
He's a Twitch streamer who we both occasionally watch. I think you slightly more than me.
I
find his videos a little bit boring. He mostly is famous for playing World of Warcraft.
Correct.
And he has built a audience on Twitch and YouTube over many years that now is, he regularly gets views in the millions and he makes a lot of money and blah, 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 blah. Now, World of Warcraft, for those who don't know it, is a massively multiplayer online role-playing game, which has a reputation for, I would say its players spending more time inside than average and being quite dedicated to the game. Mm. And so Matt told me this guy has a house tour. And so I'm like, okay, great. Yeah. So he looks like, I guess you would say, your typical kind of like greasy gamer guy. He's got like long hair, long beard. He clearly just like doesn't cut it. And I'm like, okay, you can't see anything in his like normal streaming background setup. I'm like, yes, hell yeah, I'm ready for his house tour. Matt tells me his house tour is insane. Okay, so I watched it. This man lives in utter filth. He lives in a house in the US that it was like, it was his parents' house, but his parents don't live there anymore. He lives there by himself. It's the house where he grew up.
Yeah.
He does not clean. He orders fast food pretty much exclusively, not totally exclusively. And he just like keeps all of the trash all around him at all times. He like has a lot of mold problems. He has a lot of just like stuff on the floor everywhere. He says, the only thing I cleaned before you came here was the bathroom because no, you didn't want to see it how it was previously.
Oof.
And okay, so this is all, so far as it goes, not that interesting, right? Like guy lives in bad conditions because he games the whole time.
Mm.
Big story.
Mm.
However, what Matt said is, I think he's okay. And I was like, are you sure? But I actually am sure that he's doing it right. He's,
wow.
Yeah.
Like doing life right.
Yes.
Okay.
And here's why. So everyone in the video is like, obviously disgusted. He did like a reaction to it where like, sorry, he published the house tour on somebody else's channel. And so then he gets to react to it with his Twitch audience reacting to his reaction. Okay. And they're all like, oh my God, this is all just like, he's saying like, no, I think this is fine. Like I live like this because I want to. And they're all like, you're crazy. Like, have you ever, I mean, my reaction was like, well, has he ever tried living in another way? Like, does he just like not know what it's like to have like a nice house? And then he goes like, no, like when you say like, this isn't okay. Like this is a problem. What you're saying is you have a problem with it and you are incapable of imagining that my mind could possibly be different. Like, actually, this is good. I like it this way. I don't clean things up because I don't want to. And I don't have to. And actually, here's one thing that's really cool and gratifying about my life. I run it precisely the way I want, for my preferences. In fact, I like try and live as little as possible in the physical world. And this felt kind of inspiring to me in a weird way. He was like, I'm on the computer most of the time, okay. He doesn't actually play WoW that much these days, I think, but he's Twitch streaming the whole day. And he's like, that's where all of my important interactions happen. That's where my relationships are. That's where my life is. Right? My life is not here. You know, there's all the stuff, and the stuff is fine so far as it goes. But like, as long as I've got like a cozy place to sleep and I've got like enough food to eat, I think I'm rich. I think I was born rich and happy and like, why would I live any other way? And like, you're just doing typical minding to me and like, go home. And I don't know. I thought that was really great.
Is he American?
Yes. He has a big American flag like his, he lives in like an attic.
That is freedom.
He has like a whole house and he lives in like an attic. And there are like dead rats and things. Anyway.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. What a guy. I was just like, actually, I think you're correct.
I mean, it's kind of this like stoicism thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, or
yeah.
Like, he's like, look, the thing that matters here is like how my reaction to it. My reaction is fine. Therefore, the thing is fine.
Yeah.
And like, if you, yeah. So it, yeah, I agree. There's like wisdom there, and like paring it down, simplifying things, being like, this is stuff that matters. This is stuff that doesn't.
Yeah. He even went like full stoic at one point where he was like, I don't know, to take an example, like it used to really bother me when temperatures were too warm. I like it to be really cold in my life. But then I realized that I could just not have that preference anymore. Ta-da! Now it's fine.
Okay, but that's like how, yeah, that seems very harder. Easy. That's like more.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I'm not sure
how psychologically accessible that one is.
Yeah, I wasn't following that one, to be honest. But
well, it is possible, though, if you believe it.
Yeah, in the UK, this shit would get cut down. Tall poppy syndrome. All that.
Yeah, do you guys know about
that? You think he'd be considered a tall poppy? Just in his spiritually? Even spiritual top poppies get to...
What are you talking about? This man lives... Yeah.
If anyone ever came by his house in the UK, they would tut.
They were more than tutting in the house tour. They were like, how? What is wrong with you?
Fuck out.
Yeah, the meta preference thing is interesting.
Yeah.
The thing where he liked it cold, but then he decided not to care anymore.
Yeah.
Because I gave a 80K kind of relevant presentation to EA New York City the other week, where I was like, guys, meta preferences are important. It was my, and maybe Joel will like this, like, my like, look, I've talked to like 800 people in my job about their careers and then like, you know, gotten some feedback over 2 years of doing it. I'm like, who lands in places that they like, that I think are like really cool places to land or that they think are cool places to land. And I'm kind of like, it's the hardcore people. The people who just like really, really want it and go for it and put the time in and put the effort in. And I don't know, people who want to compromise and like land somewhere in the middle and get a little bit of this and a little bit of that and do work-life balance and stuff like that. sometimes do okay, but just like at a much, much lower rate than the people who are just like, all I want to do is understand this problem and tackle it head on and do more. And so my talk was basically like, look, I've noticed this thing where like people who prefer to really go for it actually get it. Like the thing that other people say they want, but like with a bunch of hedges. Should you like just spend a bunch of time, you know, talking to yourself and your friends about whether you want to be the kind of person who really goes for it and really gets it and experimenting with what that is like and seeing whether it is the kind of thing you'd get behind. I don't think many people do that kind of experimentation, and maybe the result of the experiment is you become that and you do the things you think are cool. I thought that maybe I was just being like trite, but it was like a new concept for a lot of people, and they were really interested in picking my brain about it in a nice way, as EAs so often are.
I think that kind of happened for me.
Yeah?
Really?
Yeah.
And now, do you now consider yourself one of these like hardcore people who really goes for it? Or maybe you don't want to say you're hardcore, but...
I mean, the past year has been a little bit of an anomaly, but in the recent past and next year, yeah, I expect very much so. And that was a switch that went off early on in America when I realised this was a meta preference one could have.
What triggered it for you?
Being around people with that meta preference, just like very, very obviously on display.
Yeah, I find there's something frightening about that kind of person.
Mm.
And maybe it's like the thing that I'm identifying as like frighteningness is like a sense of my own inadequacy reflected in them or whatever. But like maybe it's also not. Maybe it's something like, I don't know, if they're pointed in the right direction, then hell yeah, you know, go for it with all that you've got. If they're not, that's kind of scary.
Can you be like obsessed with really going for it and hardcore in this sense without being myopic or like, is there like a, do those need to go together? You could think that it's all about like, because there's like, I feel like there's a focus version and then there's just like an energy version.
Yeah.
Which is like, I just want to do the good thing. And you like could actually like change the thing or like change your mind a bunch or whatever, but you're like really obsessed with doing the good thing or something. And maybe that's less scary.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you that in principle that's possible. But I do sort of feel like the moods are conflicting, or at least in a bit of tension somehow, where it's like the way you're like, what I really care about is doing the good thing. You're like, okay, so if there's a reason why I'm going in the wrong direction, it's important to notice that and like really think about it, carefully consider it. Is it true? And then do it or not. And I feel like that's going to be hard.
There's like a self-doubt mode or something that feels like it's like emotionally in tension with like, I don't know. I kind of feel like I feel like I know people who I would describe as like obsessive and hardcore, but not like super confident and not like, so like they're kind of, I think it does like, maybe it's like negative in some ways because it becomes like angsty about like, you know, like always like worried about like, is this the right thing? And like, am I going to, but like, and am I achieving it? And like, it's not, but it does feel like there's at least, I don't know if this profile would also, according to Matt's recent study, end up being successful, but it feels like there is this like really trying aspect that can go with this kind of like self-doubt thing. It seems less pleasant than the other one, which is the kind of like Silicon Valley entrepreneur, like ultra confident, overconfident, but it's a virtue and like kind of whatever one, but it seems like a thing to me.
Well, Julia Galef makes this like, I assume everyone here has read The Scout Mindset.
Yeah.
She makes this distinction between epistemic confidence and social confidence.
Hmm.
And her stories are like, well, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos, like, both said that their projects, you know, only had a 10% chance of success or whatever when they started, but they were all in and they were like working hard every day, trying to make it happen, telling people it would happen. I mean, not necessarily in a way that conflicts with their epistemic view, but saying like, hey, given how great this thing is, 10% is plenty. Like, and let's go, let's do it. And I don't know, is that like kind of what you're pointing to, Arden?
I think that might be like, somebody might say that is the ideal, where the thing I'm pointing to is more like a mood that can go along with the epistemic unconfidence, but that can still be hardcore and really trying. That might be more common than that. Like, I feel like people feel sort of surprised that that's possible. They're like, oh, like you can have, you can like, think that something only has a 10% chance and also be like fully committed to the trying it and going for it. Whereas this one feels like more common or more like easily psychologically kind of like accessible. So not quite, but somewhat.
Where do you sit on the spectrum?
Where do I sit on the spectrum? I think I've often been kind of the type, or have sometimes been the type that I was just describing. It's like angsty, but like pretty like obsessive about it, or like pretty, like committed to trying to do the thing in like the all the ways possible or something. And then I think I've like kind of gone a bit less like that. Maybe similarly had like a slightly less like that year, I think, than normal recently. But I'd like to go back to the like motivational part and maybe like try to dial down the angst and try to go maybe that would be the direction that I will try to go through.
That would be the ideal.
Do you know where I'm trying to segue?
Yeah.
You don't want to talk about it. So Joel was having a going away celebration last night, and Arden and I were in attendance. I think Bella was in attendance for part of it, but she wasn't at the pub when we brought up a recent job posting from 80,000 Hours that we're looking for a CEO. I think all the kind of applications are in. The process is still ongoing. And it was kind of a funny job ad because It mentioned that in addition to a CEO, we may also need a director of the website, special projects, or internal systems, which sort of implied that there might be some internal candidates for the CEO role. And one of those was the director of the website, who is Arden. And yeah, how are you feeling about the process of applying for CEO and your own kind of like aspirations and attitude toward it?
Yeah, so I reserve the right to cause all of this to be cut later. Mm-hmm. But yeah, how have I been feeling about the process? And then I'll talk about, yeah, how I'm feeling about the idea of being in the role. The process has been kind of like fairly painless for me, but I think it's partly because of my... Yeah, so I was going to try to separate these, but it seems like maybe this is not going to happen. One thing to say is that this is not the first time I've been through this. So we've done a lot of CEO transitions at ADK while I've been here. This is the third such transition and the second that I've been a candidate in. And so there was like, I actually like, you know, looked up in my drive, like reasons Arden shouldn't be CEO. And there was like two different docs with like different dates. And I'm like, okay, great. I can like start drawing from these. I think I have maybe for the first time in my life, so the true answer is for the first time in my life, I feel kind of like unsure whether to try to go for the like bigger and more ambitious thing. And I feel like I have this heuristic that I've had for a while, which is like, just try to do the thing that's like harder, but like bigger in some way. And that I think has mostly served me fairly well and I feel pretty good about it. But usually it's very also emotionally gripping. So it's not just like, I should do this because this is a way to have more positive impact. Like that's part of it. But it's also like, I'm drawn to do it because of some sort of like ambition drive thing. And this time I felt like really ambivalent about the idea of being 80,000 hour CEO. And there's a couple mm-hmm. reasons for this. And like, I think I don't like totally understand them. I feel like some of them are like things that I have to like untangle psychologically, but I feel more like I want to only do it if I actually feel like it's going to make the world a better place, and I have like have a more of a pure that motivation than I think I usually do with work stuff, where I'm like it's more like a mix. I'm kind of like because I feel like it could make me less happy. And I feel afraid of that. I think it could be like, that could be overcome by other things. But yeah. And I think I have some sense of like, I feel like there's still lots to do in my current role. I feel excited about a bunch of the stuff that we can do on web. And I want to be able to, and I have the desire to be able to do something well in a way that's like, I'm like, oh, we might actually be able to do this well. And then, like, if I become CEO, it's like, I'm going to do the things that are going to be harder, and I probably won't feel like I do them well. And, like, you know, that kind of sense of, like, being out of my depth, which is something I feel like I've tried to go for before, I'm now, like, feeling less appetite for. So I'm like, honestly, I feel quite trepidatious about the idea. So if I am 80,000-hour CEO, I will, like, I will gear myself up, and I will have the pep talks, and I will have the things, and I will be like, we're doing this, and I'll be, like, energetic about it. But I feel like I need to decide, if that does end up happening, I need to decide that I want to and am willing to be in that mode. Because, like, right now I'm kind of, like, I feel sort of holding back. And so, yeah, the process has been painless because they just ask questions, and I just, like, well, here's the truth. And, like, you know, it's been kind of easy since I don't, like, part of me, I don't know how to feel about the outcome.
I was not involved in this process at all, but I do know some about the CEO role, partly because I acted as chief of staff to Brenton as interim CEO for a couple months. Seems like a really hard job. I think it makes a load of sense that you'd be feeling that way.
Yeah. It also seems like, I said this last night, but I'm like, I'll get, like the projects that I'm most emotionally attached to, because I've been like thinking about them a bunch for the web program, I'll have like less ability to make them happen. And I like think I'll probably struggle with the fact that I will be less involved with web stuff. And then like I'll be more involved with projects that I at least am not yet as emotionally involved with, which like things that like, I don't know, what should our salary policy be? Like for, you know, I've been happy to not care about that until, you know, but like, I don't have to care about that. That seems, you know, that'll be a change.
You have a lot more complicated inner life than I do.
What? What a strange reaction.
Yeah, say more. Or is there, maybe there's no more than that.
I wonder if there is no more than that. Yeah, that was a lot of thinking. I think you once asked me why I was excited about manifold regranting, and I said because I think it's beautiful, and you wanted it felt like you wanted many more layers of detail about what the theory of impact was. And why in particular do I feel excited about this versus some other thing that I could be doing with my time? And that's not going on in my head.
Mm-hmm.
it just seems really beautiful to me.
Hmm.
What?
Joel, can I go in the incredibly insensitive direction that I want to go?
In terms of
what's going on in your head or not going on in your head?
Yes, okay.
I'm so curious.
Our special guest, Joel, has a condition known
oh,
as...
Oh, God.
You didn't know that was where I was going?
No, not at all, but yeah, we can do it.
Joel has aphantasia, which Joel taught me just the other day, also means that you don't have sound in your head either.
I don't know that that's what it means.
Yeah,
I don't have sound.
Well, you don't...
Oh, okay. Oh, for Joel.
Sorry, and what is the other thing What is the mainline thing it means?
I don't have any visual imagery.
No, okay, no visual imagery, no sound.
Yeah. I close my eyes, block my ears. I've no idea what you look like.
You can't picture it.
No, I can't picture it.
Yeah.
I think that like aphantasia is like many things is a spectrum. So some people like at least claim to be able to like visualize in full detail everything that they, you know, or like many things that they can imagine. Where I think I'm probably like, I don't know if it's 1 to 10 or like a 4 or 3 or something. I don't have a very good visual imagination, but it's there. And then some people are 0, and that's pretty wild.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm not dreaming.
You never dream.
Not never dream, but very rare. It's become increasingly rare.
Mm.
And when it does happen, it's not at all visual, and I guess it would be visual for you.
Yeah.
You know, Matt says shit like, oh, I said, I've got the song stuck in my head. And he was like, oh, how can you have that song stuck in your head if you don't... Maybe I'm telling the...
No. That is basically what I said. It wasn't a very nice thing to say, but I said it.
And I was like, well, you know, I don't mean, like, I can literally hear it. I just mean, I don't know, I kind of want to sing it. I, like, I'd like to get the guitar out and do this whole thing. And he told me that he's, like, plagued by all these noises going on
yeah.
in his head all the
yeah.
time. That's literally what he means by the phrase.
Yeah.
That's part of it.
Have those of you who are not Joel noticed that sound hallucinations are like, way harder to distinguish between real sounds? Or like, sounds that you hear in your head are way harder to distinguish between real sounds from real sounds than... like visual things that you like might imagine. So like there's this, it's almost so.
See, this
no,
is
no, no, I mean,
up.
I try not to, because I did, you know, years ago, I did have this aphantasia realization when I was like 21 or something.
Mm-hmm.
That when people say they imagine, you know, they fantasize, whatever, they like literally fucking mean. They like have this image in their head.
Yeah.
And I was surprised at that time, and now people say all these outrageous things about imagining things, and I'm calm in the face of things. But you struggle to distinguish.
Sometimes. So here's the thing that has never happened to me.
Mm.
I have never mistaken a mental image for a image. An outside my head image.
Yeah.
Okay. But it happens to me sometimes that it's like, you think you hear a knock on the door, or you think you hear a like, or like you can't remember if like a second ago the music was actually playing, or it was just like, you were just imagining it in your head. Like that somehow they're much closer than in the visual case.
And I think this is why auditory hallucination is just much more like, I don't know, pernicious. Like
you two nodding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is true for everyone, but this feels true for me. Well, I mean, the actual thing I was thinking of when Adam was talking is I get sleep paralysis.
So when I'm having a sleep paralysis hallucination, it's literally indistinguishable from reality at the time.
And it's visual?
Yeah, visual and auditory.
Okay.
It's actually really...
It's a 3 or a 4.
Well, no, when I'm dreaming, it's very vivid.
Yeah.
And the sleep paralysis is kind of like dreaming, except for I think that I'm in the place that I'm in fact in. So it's like I see exactly what I'd see if I'd opened my eyes, plus whatever horrible thing is happening to me because it's sleep paralysis. But it's like much, much more vivid than I can like close my eyes and call to my brain. Like I can't imagine it as vividly as I can during sleep paralysis or dreaming. I don't know why.
This is a lot to take in. one of the things that came to mind when I guess maybe not came to mind, I don't know. That just means some literal fucking thing for you guys. you see some... I really like jamming. I really like sing-alongs. And sometimes, you know, I like to do my little harmonies or something. It just kind of feels right. But if you're hearing things, can't you just like, you know, can't you just be searching that shit all the time, like finding all the best harmonies? How are you not just, you know, contributing Mozart-like works every second of every day?
It feels hard for some reason to like generate the sounds on purpose. Well, no, I actually do. No, this is kind of, I think this is kind of a good question.
So here's my explanation of what's going on. When you're thinking, about words and concepts, you could be like doing 4 parallel streams of thought at once. That's kind of hard, right? Like most of you stick to one.
Yeah.
And like, if you really want to think about something deeply and make it like good and like make sense, you've got to be thinking about one thing. You could only be thinking kind of absentmindedly about like 2+, right? Or at least that's my experience. And I think it's just the same thing with music. It's like, if you want to be imagining like a full orchestra in your head, you're probably basically focusing on like 1 or 2 instruments that you're actually like...
Oh, but whatever. Like Mozart's doing this, presumably. He has the, you know, he has some high-level ideas about harmony or something, and then he's imagining just the violin, and then he's imagining...
No, so what I'm saying about like, in the same way that you get some people who are like unusually good at like mental multitasking, thinking about concepts and words, you also get some people who are unusually good at like composing symphonies, right? And that's like the Mozart type. And then like you have like me and Arden, who are just like, you know, I can like remember a pop song.
Average Joe's.
Yeah, I can like, you know, I can put the vocals in. I can maybe put 3 instruments in if I try, but I'm not really, you know, like I'm not really doing the whole instrumentation. I'm just like doing a bit of it, whatever.
But here is a fun special power of this. I do like, but it's also kind of an anti-power. So if you're like singing, I feel like when I'm singing, I like hear the instrumentals in my head to go along with the vocals, which makes me sound great. So like I always like have, I think I have the sensation of being a better singer than other people hear me as.
I mean, people do say, or at least there are these famous examples of very creative, even visually creative, aphantastics. Like people, maybe the founder of Pixar, or I can't remember, something like this. And maybe, all of you that are, you know, hearing these songs in your head are terrible singers, and the rest of us are well calibrated.
Like Beethoven.
Like Beethoven,
I mean, I've always thought that my relative lack of visual imagination was part of the reason why I was so bad at drawing. As like a kid, I really wanted to be good at drawing. Because, I don't know, I thought art was pretty. I wanted to be good at it.
Yeah.
And I was just consistently really terrible. And like, I could kind of copy something from a reference image, but without a reference image, I was just terrible. Because I couldn't.
Yeah. Me too.
Why did, actually, like, here, sorry. I think this is a boring question, but it might be an interesting question. Why do kids want to draw? Like, what is it? When you say you thought art was pretty, I was like, I had a moment where I was like, surely not. Like, surely art is not that pretty compared to, like, real life. Or, like, video games. Or, like...
I mean, do you want to know the real motivation for me as a child?
Yeah.
So I went through various phases of being really into particular topics as a child. And the topics were, in order, dragons, wolves, vampires. Oh, no, in between, ponies. Then vampires. I was very into, and like, these are just like things, like one of my pastimes when I think I was like 4 or something and had like my first, you know, computer, was just like Googling dragons and looking at all of the like JPEGs that you can find on Google Images.
and it would like save them to a folder, mm-hmm. and, like catalog the JPEGs.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, Matt has a story like this too.
No. This is great. I mean, Bella's just so far ahead of me, is what I'm kind of musing on. When I first got Encarta. Do you remember Encarta? No,
what's Encarta?
You're
no.
made.
I'm sorry. I thought I knew we were having a moment there, but now I've ruined it.
Before there was like there was the internet, but before many people had it, mm-hmm. Before there was Wikipedia, Microsoft thought, we're going to have a digital encyclopedia, and it's just going to be something we all wrote down one time, and we're going to call it Encarta, and you're going to buy it, and it's going to come on discs. And my dad like brought it home one day, and he's like, kids, you can learn anything you want. Just ask it anything. And the first thing I typed in was dogs.
Yeah, the universal nice. Human impulse to look at pictures of dogs.
Yeah. And then Bella's doing dragons.
Yeah. I know Bella's thing is great.
Yeah, Bella's so much better than me.
And so I would love to draw, you know, I would love to have been able to draw my own dragons.
Yeah, yeah.
And I tried, but I was very bad at it. Mm. And I wish that I was good at it.
I think dragons are difficult things to draw.
Well, they can kind of be anything you like. You don't have to adhere to anatomy, so that's one advantage.
Mm-hmm.
But what is the impulse to draw the dragon? To create the new... Is it because you want to create a custom dragon that has features that you own?
Definitely in one case, yes. So I remember drawing a hybrid between a pony and a dragon.
Okay.
That was
yeah.
my own... It came from my own mind.
Yeah.
And I named it after a RuneScape character. And... Maybe it's just like my own, but I think it's partly universal. I just like saw these beautiful images and I was like, I would love to create like that. But I
universal is strong.
Okay, sorry.
in light of the person to our left.
Yeah.
I mean, the urge to create just generally seems like it should be kind of present. Just like I made
yeah,
things
yeah.
and they came from me and they're
yeah.
mine. As opposed to just the stuff that happened to be out there. Even I'll acknowledge now, in my maturity, that the stuff out there is better than anything I can create. But the stuff that I create is mine.
Yeah. I just, like, wonder in my own case. So I also really loved drawing as a kid. But partly, I think, in my own case, it was because I felt... So I think I was fairly good at realistic drawing. So I, like... and that was, like, a... So it felt like a talent. And so that was like something that made it satisfying.
Mm.
And I was like proud of it. And I wonder whether would have been into it if not for that. And then like, I think I felt influenced by a romanticism of like art museums, artists, like the tradition of art and the idea of like capturing things, being itself with this kind of like romantic act or something. And like, I just kind of like wonder how I would have kind of, I'm just like, why would I have done it if not for those two things? And maybe I would still have because I would have just wanted to create a thing and it's one of the most easy ways to create a thing. But yeah.
I mean, also just like you're a kid, you have a load of free time and nothing to do. And like, this is kind of fun.
But this is a very common thing for kids to like love doing. Whereas
yeah.
like there's so many other activities that kids could be obsessed with.
Yeah.
That and so, yeah. Why this one? That's the question. I mean, it is something about accessibility.
Crayons are cheap.
Crayons are cheap.
But your phone camera.
I actually...
Now.
Keep
today,
the phones away from the children.
But they already have them.
Today for the first time in maybe ever.
You did what today?
Did you go back to drawing?
No.
Oh.
I bought crayons. It was for work.
look forward
oh,
to
for
some this. Excellent 80,000 hours working content, everyone.
I don't know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I do.
And they were £1.80, which is not very much money.
Nice.
For like a pack of 24. I was like, how are they this cheap?
Hey, crayons are actually surprisingly good art tools. Like, they last forever. The colors can be extremely vivid.
Mm-hmm.
They're like quite satisfying to like color with. Like, it's like the wax feeling is very nice. Like, yeah, I don't know. I think people sleep on them because they're associated with children.
Yeah. And, like, children putting them up their nose and stuff. That's what I think of.
Yeah.
Or eating them. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that is just enough time for me to fight Bella. Should we fight?
Physically?
I mean, yes, if you're offering.
No.
But,
I'm confused. Why are we fighting?
I shared with you one of my very, very favorite kind of like EA-related pieces of content earlier, and you...
Oh, no, I didn't finish it, so I feel like we can't do this.
Okay, you dissed it pretty quickly, though.
Yeah, I did.
Okay. And
maybe the discussion is still going to be interesting.
Okay, awesome. In a future episode, when Bella has read all of Joe Carl Smith's On Sincerity, we may discuss it. It is the best thing. I read it every holiday, 2 years running, as long as it's existed. I think it really speaks to like the thing that I think is happening with people like us. Have you guys read On Sincerity by Joe Carl Smith?
No.
Okay. Highly recommend.
Yes, but I have very bad recall.
What's the thing that it's saying that you feel is resonating with you?
So, yeah, the thesis is like, Joe says, there's this thing that I call sincerity, where like, I guess I would summarize it as like being very truth-seeking, and he thinks that like deep, deep reflection like helps you arrive at valuing like some altruistic idea. And I don't know, he connects them very well, and he uses examples, and he talks about meta-ethics, as Joe always likes to talk about meta-ethics. And he's like, there are some people, like, I don't know, everything that I read from Joe, I think, if I had to, like, put one common thread through it, would be like, okay, like, what if reality were, like, really real? I mean, I have a funny relationship with reality myself, but sometimes I think, I don't know. So I see him as like saying like, look, there is a sensible like solipsistic impulse that you might have because all the evidence you have about the world is fundamentally solipsistic. It is like just your observation, just your experience. You know, when I leave this room, like you three, to some meaningful degree, are going to disappear from me. Yet intellectually, I sort of accept the idea that you are real and living independently of me, and you do matter and all that stuff, but just at a really deep gut level, there's some part of me that doesn't buy it because I'm just being me the whole time. And Joe is like, take incredibly seriously this thing that you intellectually endorse, that those other people are real and they're having experiences, the way that people you've never met are having experiences, the way that people who haven't been born yet are going to have experiences and things like that. And I don't know, he's quite poetic, and he goes into all kind of chapter and verse about it. And I think makes a coherent argument too. I'm always interested in, and maybe you guys have opinions about this, like what are the kind of like foundational, like really, really deep foundational effective altruist like materials that like best describe why I like identify with this set of ideas.
Materials, and, you mean like literally written materials?
Yeah. And or so like I think that sincerity is as close as I get. I think it's like a little assumption loaded or whatever. It's like not the platonic ideal of what I would point to, but it is like one of the best things I found.
So the idea being that something like, if you really take seriously the idea that like other people and stuff exists, then you have to like, just, your actions are the overwhelmingly most important thing about your actions is how it affects those things or something.
Yeah, and, like, and you reflect on it, you'll realize that like, the realer you think people are, the more empathy you have for them. And one, I guess I'll just put my own personal twist on this, but I really do want like recommendations for you guys. If you guys have anything that comes to mind, is like foundational. I think like, man, I am so, so good to my future self. I'm saving money. I'm like thinking about the situations that guy is going to be in. I'm like taking care of him, but he's not like really, really me. Like he may never come to exist because I could get hit by a bus on my way home, but I'm taking all these precautions because I know that there will be this person experiencing these things later, and I'm like really attentive to that. And that's like selfish and biased because I like only have my experiences. What if I treated all potential experiences like future bad experiences? Man, I'd be taking a lot better care of other people. And that's like the effect of altruist in me.
Yeah.
Other content stuff that you guys like, you think is foundational. What do you got?
What do we got? First of all, that sounds cool. And I like that gloss. There's a Richard Noe post that I liked that I don't know if I want to say this is foundational, but it felt like it really spoke to me, which is like the core thing in that the most important part of utilitarianism is scope sensitivity. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's kind of making this a very similar point or something, but it like is trying to say like, you don't need all the philosophy around this. Like the only thing you need to like get the most important conclusions is scope sensitivity. And I like felt pretty compelled by that. And so you can just be like, scope sensitive ethics.
Yeah.
I'm really on board with that.
Yeah,
I said that the first time we met. I think EA Pitches should basically be that.
EA Pages?
Pitches. Like the big idea of scope sensitivity.
Yeah.
We actually tried using it as the like hook. It didn't go super well, but I would like to try again. That like the I don't remember who it's by. Shut up and multiply,
which is similar to that.
What's type of multiply by?
I don't know. Holly Elmore, we are in triage every minute of every day, whatever it's called. That one was really foundational for me. I think it said things that I sort of already knew, but in a very evocative way. I guess on caring generally, I'm struggling to point to any particular part of it now that I'm like, wow, that was really important for me. This one's not so well known, but I think super like, in terms of with like post-length things that Bella's read where she's been like, oh wow, yeah, this is pain is not the unit of effort. It's a Les Rom post. You guys read it?
I've never read it, but I hear that title quoted a lot.
Yeah, man. Because I think I used to think the pain is the unit of effort, and it's not. That's the summary.
Nice.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of the things you guys pointed to are things that would be met well by somebody who already thought of themselves as altruistic at all. And be like, oh, do you realize there's like so many more opportunities here? Scope sensitivity, this and that. Whereas I think that Joe's thing, and the thing that I like about it, is it tries to say like, you know, why be altruistic in the first place? Why even have this impulse on which you can like, build some scope sensitivity? And yeah, I don't know if it was like ever a big question for you guys because you're more inherently altruistic than me, but it was a big question for me coming from kind of like right libertarianism as I did, ideologically speaking.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this is going to convince any right libertarians, but Strangers Drowning by Larissa McFarquhar is pretty much like that.
Although this is like a philosophical argument, kind of, right?
Yeah.
And this that one's more like inspiration. They show the people doing the thing, and it's kind of like, wow, this is possible.
I mean, there's like some chapters where the author interjects, and she's just like writing. I wouldn't call it philosophy precisely. It's not like making a clear argument, but it is like some reflection on the common threads and like reasons and stuff like that. I think there's like three chapters like that or something.
I'm trying to think if I know anything else. Because I feel like there are, like... I do feel like I'm not in the category of people who was sort of, like, always super altruistic and just looking for a way to, like, do it well. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like I, like... needed a bit of convincing or something. Somewhat. And I'm trying to think if there are things that did that. And I feel like... Yeah, I feel like for me, it was actually just seeing people actually do it. So maybe that means I had a bit of it already. I didn't like, it was kind of more like, this isn't like a possible way to live, or like nobody would actually takes this seriously. And then seeing people take it seriously, it was just like, well, that's clearly better. That's just clearly the way to be. So yeah, maybe that means that there was like some of that in me already.
What about you?
Yeah, I think I am more one of those people who always felt some altruistic impulse or whatever. But I think the main thing that was stopping me from ever doing anything about it is that I felt some kind of all-encompassing hopelessness that there was any actual prospect to affect real change. And so I think the main thing that I needed was somebody to just be like, have you considered just going and doing whatever it is that you best can do? Like, have you considered just acting like there is something that it is possible to make a difference.
Bella, are you excited about your TED Talk?
Yes, sorry. That's the subject of my TED Talk, which comes out, I don't know if it will be after this thing comes out. Yeah, it's... I haven't settled on a title, but the basic topic...
Crayons.
Oh, great. Yes. Sorry. It does involve crayons, which is why I bought crayons.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it's going to be in Oxford. It's hopefully going to be good. Yeah. It's like trying to talk to that person who is in a position that I feel like I was in, which is like, oh my God, everything is so awful. And like, therefore run and hide. Rather than like, and therefore do something. Yeah.
Nice. Joel, Joel, is there anything you want to tell the world before you wrap?
Thank you very much, Matt and Bella and Arden, for having me. This was very lovely. I want to tell the world that. And what else? You can follow my dog on Instagram.
that's Mushu. What's the Instagram tag?
Fuck, I actually can't remember that. Oh, no. It's either it's.mr_Mushu or it's_mr.mushu. Probably that one. Probably the second one.
it's.mr_Mushu. Awesome.
That's it.
Your dog is wonderful. He's been staying at my place for the last few days. Well, thanks so much for coming on and letting me mostly grill you for the first half and then chill out a little bit in the second half. Everyone, keep an eye out for Bella's TED Talk, which I will be given before this comes out, almost certainly.
Okay.
And then I don't know, TED Talk release schedules are...
Yeah, how long?
Yeah, I have no sense of when, but it will eventually be uploaded to YouTube.
It's going to be great.
Thank you. I hope so.
All right, well, thanks for joining us, everyone.
Yeah.
Take care.